It's never too early to play holiday music, and it's never too early to start thinking about gifts. Whether it's for a friend or the friend in your pants, you can make this season to be jolly with Manscaped. Do your little drummer boy a favor and use the Lawnmower 4.0 to avoid another silent night in the bedroom. Then add in Manscaped's top-of-the-line shower products to have the people thinking, all I want for Christmas is you. Santa cares about his sack, and so should you. Look nice when you get naughty by going to manscaped.com and using the promo code POWERTRIP20 for free shipping and 20% off. Now that you've groomed your candy cane, it's time to make sure you don't smell like a reindeer with the Platinum Packages shower products. All of Manscaped shower gear is sulfate-free, vegan, and made to have your skin feeling hydrated and smelling fresh. But smelling good doesn't stop at the shower. The Crop Preserver Ball Deodorant and Crop Reviver Ball Toner can solve stank problems all day long. Once they touch your sack, you'll never go back. So get 20% off and free shipping with the promo code POWERTRIP20 at manscaped.com. That's 20% off with free shipping at manscaped.com. Just use that promo code POWERTRIP20. Manscaped. Get your jingle balls ready for the holidays.
The upcoming presentation is a two-man power trip of wrestling podcast production.
What's up, guys? It's the phenomenal AJ Styles. You're listening to the two-man power trip.
Hey, Johnny. Cool, man. What's going on? We ready to go or what?
Welcome to the two-man power trip of wrestling. I'm your host, JP John Paz, with me today. Very special guest, former NWA Junior Heavyweight Champion. You may know him as Downtown. He is Mr. Denny Brown. Denny, welcome to two-man power trip. How you doing?
Well, I'm doing well, thank you. And that's Junior Heavyweight Champion of the world.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Well said.
That's important. Of the world.
Yes.
So well, what's going on? Nice to be here.
So what's going on in your world? What have you been up to?
Well, I'm retired now, and I do a, you know, like in the brief conversation you had earlier, I bought this house that I told you was built back in 1960. I bought just going on 3 years now, and retired in 2018. And I go, you know, I've been working on the house ever since I moved in here, and fishing all the time, and I'm still pretty active. I go to the gym and work out and try to stay healthy.
Doing anything wrestling related?
Well, I do. I just haven't done a whole lot of it. A little bit of signings here and there, you know, not anything really great. You know, a lot of people looking, you know, beating down my door, which is fine. You know, I'm not, I don't really go promoting myself for it. I did get one that came up to you, last week that I was set up to go to the Gathering 4 in Charlotte, North Carolina in August 2023, set up as a second VIP guest. It was just come out of the blue. And then the day after I got that, I got your text and, you know, wanting to do an interview. So I started going, wow, you know, things are maybe things are going to change. Maybe people are starting to seek me out and want to start talking more about, you know, the things that's going on in my life, and, you know, my history with wrestling, and maybe what, you know, got me to the point to where I actually got into wrestling, because it wasn't my intent to become a wrestler. I didn't grow up saying I'm going to become a professional wrestler. It wasn't the plan. You know, my plan was to become a steel worker, iron worker, and, you know, I was a welder.
So how did you go from that to becoming a wrestler? How did you get in then?
Well, I come out of the Navy. I was in the Navy, you know, 1973 to 1977. And, you know, and technically, or basically, I really went into the Navy because, you know, I wanted to get away from everybody else that was, you know, that I was growing up within the neighborhood that would, you know, they weren't having a good life because most of them were getting in trouble and headed off to jail or prison or whatever. And I go, well, I ain't hanging out with these guys. I don't want to do that. And I don't want to end up in jail or prison. So I went to the recruiter's office and joined the Navy. And I spent 4 years in the Navy as a hull technician. You know, so we did basically ship's repair. I was a firefighter, carpenter worker, metal worker, steel worker, pipe fitter, you know, just everything. Anything that you could do on a ship to repair, that's what I did. So that was when I got out of the Navy, I went to welding school. And that was the, you know, I figured, well, you know, if I had a trade, because that's what everybody's trying to get you to do today is, you know, have a trade. And it was always something I could fall back onto anyway. And it always ended, helped me get into wrestling as well, because once I started wrestling, I went to Knoxville, Tennessee, because there wasn't really any jobs here in Florida. So I went to Knoxville because my uncle was up there, and he was with the operator engineers. And he said, well, you can come up here and I can get you a job with the union out of Knoxville. And, you know, you go with the Boilermakers and, you know, get certified, you know, for your welding school and come up here and I'll get you a really good job. So I did. And when I went up, so I got up there and I had to go take another welding test. And, you know, so I passed and all that. And then the guy that we did the test with and everything tried to get me hooked up on the Boilermakers union. And they were very clannish. Once they found out that I wasn't from Knoxville or from Tennessee, they said, there is no way in hell that you're going to be with the Boilermakers. So I got to Knoxville, got all this welding experience and did certified and all this other stuff, and I had no job.
Wow. So yeah. That's how wrestling came about. You needed to work. You needed to get a job.
Yeah. It's kind of a strange thing, you know, my uncle said he knew there was a guy that, you know, out of Knoxville, Rick Connors. I don't know if you ever heard of Rick Connors, who just, you know, that's all he did. He was, you know, he liked to go to the different colleges and the high schools, and he worked out with all the wrestling teams, University of Tennessee, Carson Newman College, every high school that he could get to during camps. Well, I didn't know him at the time, but my uncle knew a guy that he had trained that was with the mill workers, and he said, I'll talk to him and maybe he might be able to help you out. Cause my uncle loved wrestling. He was a, you know, big fan and wanted me, you know, he just couldn't wait, you know, something like that to happen. So he started pushing me towards it and everything. And I go, and I was not a big guy, you know, I was like, you know, just under 5'8", 165 pounds. And then I said, well, I said, this not a, probably a good move for me. I'm not big enough to be a wrestler. And he goes, just go out and try. So he got a hold of the guy, got his name, and nobody knew how to get a hold of the guy, Rick Connors, who was training everybody. And he didn't know how to get a hold of him. But he says he hangs out at a restaurant at night called Shoney's. So I call the Shoney's and I give the manager my name and number. And I said, this is crazy. This is ludicrous. And a couple of weeks later, I get a call. And it's from Rick Connors.
All because of Shoney's. Wow.
Yeah.
Good old Shoney's. Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, Shoney's Frisch's Big Boy, I guess, is another name from him, probably from down here. And so, you know, I'm talking to him, and, you know, this is a guy that's, you know, won Tough Man contest. You know, he's just, you know, he's feared among a lot of the wrestlers because he was not only a wrestler, but he was a boxer. And, you know, a lot of people, and he was tough as he could be. And, man, and I didn't know him from Adam at that point in time. And he, so we're talking on the phone. So he starts sizing me up, and he goes, "Well, how tall are you?" And I go, "About 5'8". And he goes, "Well, we typically like you to be about 6 foot." And I go, "Well, can't help you there. I'm not going to grow anymore."
Yeah.
And he goes, "Well, how much do you weigh?" And I go, 165. He goes, "Dang." He goes, "Well, we don't typically, you know, we want you to be about 200 pounds. And I go, "Well, I can gain weight." But I never got over to, I never got to 200 pounds anyway, regardless. But I did start gaining weight because my aunt, she was a heck of a cook, and boy, I ate all the time, everything she cooked, and I ate. So he goes, "Well, you know, I have a thing that I'm going to do over at the Bubble, over at University of Tennessee. And he says, if you're interested, come on down and I'll give you a tryout." So I show up at the Bubble, and I meet Rick. He's got another guy with him, a guy that he did some, you know, that he rolls with, as they call it, you know, getting on the match, rolling and stuff like that. But he was a judo guy. So we get out there to the Bubble, and they got wrestling mats everywhere because that's where the University of Tennessee wrestling team trained. And so he put me through the typical normal exercises, the squats, the push-ups, the sit-ups, you know, everything. And I did all that. And then he says, "Well, I want you to get on the mat with this kid." And I don't remember his name because it's so long ago. So me and this kid, we start wrestling, shooting, you know, amateur style wrestling. And I was pretty scrappy anyway, you know, because of growing up, you know, I had to fight my whole dadgum life growing up, from my brothers to everybody in the neighborhood, and sometimes even my dad. So we got around, we rolled around and wrestled for a little while, you know, and the guy couldn't take me down, he couldn't beat me, and he couldn't hold me down, and, you know, and I went after him, and kind of pretty even. And then, you know, so Rick watches for a while, and he goes, "All right, my turn." Well, then I got my true taste of what wrestling was about, because, boy, yeah, he put me through it pretty good. You know, he rubbed my face into the mat and stuff like that, you know, typical type stuff to try to discourage you from it and all that, you know. Then he didn't do it. He didn't discourage me. Oh, you know, because I figured, heck, as much as I've been through, if that's all you got, maybe you can beat me up, maybe you can out-wrestle me, but I'm not done.
Right.
So he goes, we can go outside, and he looks at me, and he goes, "Well," he says, "you are a little small, but if you're interested, I'll be back here tomorrow." Tells me, you know, "I'll be here probably at 4 o'clock tomorrow. If you're interested, come on back tomorrow." I did. I showed up every day for 2 years. And I talked to him all the time, and he always says, he says, "Dang," he said, "yeah, yeah." He said, "I did everything in the world I could do to run you off. I beat you up. He took me out to the football field. He'd rub my face into the grass. I'd have grass stains on my teeth. He'd bust my ears open. I'd be bleeding from my ears. And I came back every single day." And he said, "Dang," he said, "I tried everything I could to run you off." And he said, "I couldn't run you off. So I said, I figured, so I tried to teach you something and maybe make a little money with it."
Why do you think he wanted to, like, run you off, though? It's just one of those things where they didn't want people in the business because of the kayfabe?
No, because I wasn't really what your typical wrestler.
Just because you were too small. You weren't his size. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, because, you know, I was 165 pounds. And so, but he kept me around, and we stayed there at University of Tennessee for a year, and I was working out with their wrestling team and him. And then I was training with this guy, Fred Jihad. He was like, he was Iranian. He was like rated fourth in the nation, you know, a wrestler, you know, amateur wrestler. And he also taught there at the University of Tennessee. So we were there every single day, sometimes twice a day, rolling around on the mats, wrestling, shooting, and going. And I'd get some of the big guys, you know, that were three times my size, and they'd squash me, and I'd pop back up, and they'd squash me again, and they'd get tired of squashing me and have to walk away. But I kept going, you know. I kept working out. I kept doing push-ups. I was doing 200 or 300 push-ups a day, squats, everything, running miles and all that. And then I'd train with Fred, the Iranian guy. And then when we get through wrestling on the mats, we'd go out to the track and we'd run sprints. And, you know, I mean, I was in shape. He really got me in shape. And I got up to about 180 pounds. So, you know, so I gained a little weight. And then the athletic director came in, a new one, Johnny Majors at the time came in, and he goes, he said, I don't, you know, you guys can't stay here and work out with our guys because we don't want them getting hurt. So we had to leave, and we went over to Carson Newman College, which was a smaller college over in Morristown, Tennessee. And they had a two-story building and a basement, or a dungeon, as they called it, is where they trained their wrestling team. And they had no heavyweights, so they welcomed me and Rick Connors. They said, yeah, come on in. So I went another year with those guys. And then we started going to every camp that they had at all the high schools. I started wrestling all the high school kids and everything. And we did this for 2 years, 2.5 years, and no place to go. And then we get wind that Jim Crockett Promotions partnered up with Ric Flair and Blackjack Mulligan to open up the Knoxville territory, because it was Southeastern, owned by the Fullers, Robert Fuller and Ron Fuller and all that. Well, they pulled out and went down to Pensacola, Florida, so there was no longer a territory. So they opened it up as a small territory along with Jim Crockett Promotions. But I never really met Jim Crockett at the time because he really wasn't any part of it. And they really weren't using me except for TV every Saturday. And a lot of the guys that were there had wrestled, you know, that were actually in the business wrestled, were never really with any territory, but they wrestled around a lot in the area. Didn't like getting beat on TV. And John Studd was there. A lot of the guys didn't like working with John Studd on TV because they were scared of him. And I had to wrestle with him and Kevin Sullivan every Saturday. And Kevin Sullivan was in shape because he was Mr. Tennessee at the time. And I was the only guy that could keep up with him. And he says, damn, he says, every time I work with you, he says, I get hurt. I'm so sorry, Kevin. I'm just, you know. But I'm in really decent shape, and Stud didn't mind, you know, because they like that, you know, because it made him look bigger than he actually was, which he was a big guy to begin with, you know. But nobody wanted to work with him because they were afraid that he would hurt them, and they didn't want to hurt their what they thought they had as prestige, or you know, their ring name or whatever it was. And I didn't care. I'd wrestle anybody. And I did. Or, you know, I'd the Mongolian Stomper. I didn't wrestle him all the time on TV. And then they finally started putting me in the ring. And I never touched the ring until they came in there. We never had a ring to wrestle with. And I didn't even start training to become a professional wrestler until after the territory opened up for them. And I got in the ring.
Man, that's kind of like really trying to make you earn it there. I mean, it's like, wow, they put you in the ringer.
I was taking backdrops on mats on the ground, the floor in the gymnasium. We'd fake like we'd run into the ropes and stuff, hold your arm up, you know, and go like you got to go hitting the ropes. But there was no ring, there was no ropes, there was no ring, there was no nothing. It was just
wow.
Right there. And then we'd meet up at Chill Howie Park, which was a boxing ring up there. And we used to go over there and we'd work out there. And Rick would say, well, all right. He said, I'm gonna show you how we punch. And he'd make me stand there and he'd just take his fist and he clubbed me right across the jaw and the neck right here. And me, we take turns. He just wouldn't hit me. He'd let me hit him too, but you had to whack him. And we'd stand there and we would whack each other and just, you know, learning how to throw punches the old school way, because that's how they hit you with a closed fist, but they hit you with the palm of the fist and not straight in.
What did you think of the territory, like as far as just that Knoxville area and really basically, you know, I guess you could say the scene, what was it like there?
That was fun. It was a blast because, I mean, it really became pretty successful. And I guess Crockett didn't like it. He ended up shutting them down. And, I mean, because they had a lot of nice talent in there. You had Les Thornton come through. You had Tony Atlas, Terry Taylor. Of course, Barry Windham, that's when he was first starting out as well. So we had Barry Windham there at the time. Tim Horner, you know, because I helped train Tim Horner. Which is, you know, that I helped train him, but he grew up a little bit faster and went to a different territory after that. But we were having some pretty decent shows and some pretty decent towns, you know, all around the Southeast up there. And they were doing pretty good. And I thought it was great. I was having a blast. And then all of a sudden, boom, Crockett got a little jealous and shut him down. He pulled out. And there we were standing around again, no place to go.
So what did you think of Ric Flair? I mean, obviously, you know, maybe the biggest name ever in the business, but what did you think about him at that point?
I didn't even know him.
So you knew nothing about him?
I didn't know him. I didn't know him from Adam. Wow. Yeah, I didn't get up there and I had to wrestle in a tag team match one Saturday, him and Ric Flair and Terry Taylor. And me and some other guy, and Rick walks up to me and goes, "You know any spots?" And I'm looking at him and I'm going, "What the heck's a spot?" Yeah, I go, yeah, whatever, you know. So we get out there and it was pretty decent match, you know. I got a little turned around, but geez, you know, I kept up with him because, you know, I didn't know I was doing spots because I didn't know the terminology, you know, as right. far as what we were doing when somebody would call a high spot. I knew it. I don't know. Whenever somebody would tell me what they wanted to do in the ring, I could see it. You know, I mean, I saw the whole, what they consider, what they call a high spot or a spot, as Flair said back then, I could see it in my head. I saw it in my mind. And if I didn't have to do a high spot, then I went back to the amateur style of wrestling and just use that. You know, we do fireman carries, you know, arm drags and stuff like that, to where, you know, waist lift takedowns, and you know, you could just, you know, I did a lot of that stuff, and that's what I used as far as, you know, my repertoire as far as, you know, how I address myself in the ring. And they liked it. And plus, I was, you know, in such great shape, and I was so fast, it was unbelievable. You know, people, you know, like Kevin, he says, "Damn, you know, it's hard to keep up with you." But he liked it because, you know, him being Mr. Tennessee and he was in shape, he was, you know, probably weighed about as much as I did, because he was a bodybuilder back in those days. But I didn't ever let him know that he hurt me too.
Right, right. It's interesting though, like, you had no idea like what spots were, what this was. I mean, even in the training, it seems like they're like keeping a kayfabe from you.
They didn't tell me anything. You know, we didn't do spots. I was just amateur wrestling. I didn't know. I was just working out with two wrestling, you know, with the wrestling teams and the other people, you know, and that's all we did. And the guy, and Rick, you know, mainly kept me around for more or less a sparring partner, somebody that he could roll with. I mean, I didn't care because when you're doing that, I mean, it's all it's doing is just making you tougher, making you stronger. And nobody ever made Rick Connors tap out. And we were over in Morristown and over at Carson Newman College, and we were shooting on the mats, and, you know, and I got him in a headlock, and he was doing everything he could get out. And I'm squeezing for the, you know, I'm holding on to his head with everything I got, all of a sudden, his skull just popped.
Oh.
Yeah. I mean, you could hear it, you know, because your skull, I think, is in three pieces of bone or whatever up there. And he tapped out. And he says, nobody's ever made me tap out before. Is that good or bad?
Right.
But boy, he didn't let up after that. Oh, I paid for it.
So did you think, like, okay, this is like a legit shoot, so to speak? Like, did you think, like, okay, this is like, because they're not teaching anything, not telling you anything, you don't know what spots are like, are you thinking it's partially a legit shoot?
Well, with him and I, it was, because that's what we were doing. You know, you shoot until, you know, it's like a, you know, we do round robins with Carson Newman College. You know, it's a 2-point takedown, and, you know, and then you get to the point where you get to a hole where you can't do anything and you tap out. I mean, they're not trying to hurt me, not trying to cripple me or anything such as that. It's just, you know, it's just, we're rolling. It's who gets the best of who. And, you know, when you're out on the mat rolling like that, it's a great, great cardio workout. It just, it builds strength like, you know, you wouldn't believe. You know, I got extremely strong. And it just, you know, and I was able to use it because, you know, I was trying to get out once they left the territory. I was trying to get out and go to some of the other territories because Chattanooga had its own territory, and of course Atlanta did TV, which I was trying to get down there, and I would just drive down and just show up, and so they would, you know, they would use you because that's what they were doing TV. They wanted guys they could use on TV, so they'd have, you know, to put their guys over. But I showed up at Chattanooga, and they had a guy that didn't show up to wrestle, and they actually stuck me in the semi-main event for my first show ever been in.
Wow.
And Nick Gulas was the promoter, and it was with Bobby Ward and Hector Guerrero. It was my first time meeting Hector, and Crazy Luke Graham was my tag team partner, and they stuck me in to fill in for the guy that didn't show up. And we had one heck of a match, and Nick Gulas, you know, I never, that's the first time I ever met him. And, you know, he had that old funny voice. He'd come in and he comes over to me after the match. He goes, oh, my boy. He says, I was one of his guys right from there on. He loved the match, and he, you know, he was surprised that I came out and did the things that I did and worked the match that I did. And I just, you know, I just went out and didn't think about it. Just did what came natural. And if you didn't know it, I'd take somebody down.
What did you think about Nick Gulas?
Well, I didn't know him all that well. I didn't, and you know, after that, that's really the only match that I ever, he never called me back, never called me up. I went down and did TV with him, and I got out there with Bobby. It was a tag match again. Bobby Eaton and Wayne Ferris, which was a honky-tonk man. And I didn't know those guys either because I didn't, you know, I'm just brand new. This is my second match, you know, outside of the Knoxville territory, you know, out in another territory. Boy, they put me in there, and Wayne Ferris just stomped the tar out of me. I was black and blue all up and down my back, and my shoulders, everything. I said something to Bobby about it years later because after I got into the business, I was in for quite a few years. He goes, that was Wayne. That wasn't me. Okay. He still stomped the tar out of me.
That's funny. Like looking back, it's like, that's honky tonk man, Bob, beautiful Bobby Eaton, Ric Flair. But you didn't know them from Adam, like you said at the time. It just, you know, it's just funny to me. Like, wow, like you were just like brand spanking new, like fresh meat at
yes.
that point.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And then I finally got a shot to go down and do TV in Atlanta, and they put me in with the Masked Superstar, Bill Eadie, and I'm still, you know, pushing, you know, 175, 180 maybe at the most, and you can pull it up on YouTube. It's still there, the Masked Superstar against me, and Bill Eadie. And, you know, I'm out there and I'm all fired up and all that stuff. And he locks up with me and I lock up with him. And he does a duck under go behind a waist lift takedown on me. I sat out on him. I started spinning in circles, boom, boom, boom. And I pop up and I stand up and I square off at him. And he's got that mask on and I see him grinning from ear to ear. He's just loving it. And, but then, he, you know, of course he's their, you know, he's their champion and they're putting him over. So he was glad. And then he come over and just took over on me and just, you know, then did his thing and beat me. And then he came back, sought me out in the dressing room, come over and shook my hand and said, thank you. He said, I beat somebody today. That was my second or third match that, you know, outside of what was going on in Knoxville.
So how'd you get booked there initially? Is that like something like Ole Anderson brings in, or how'd you get booked there initially?
I drove down and showed up.
Wow. And you just said, hey, I'm Daddy Brown. I can wrestle.
I got my bag in my hand. They said, no, wherever you go, just show up. When I went to Chattanooga, I had my bag in my hand and just showed up and walked into the dressing room. And, you know, I said, told them who I was, been training with Rick Honor. Just tell me to go sit down. And if they needed me, they'd come over. If you got your bag and your boots, and you're ready to go. So that's what I did.
Pretty like, I don't know, ballsy of you in a certain aspect. You know what I mean? Like, hey, I can wrestle. I'm ready if you want me to wrestle.
Yeah. Well, Rick had put, you know, I had a kind of his philosophy and, you know, his ideology and training with him. You know, I was in pretty good shape and I didn't think about it, you know, and I'm going, it just, you know, if you're going to get out here and go and you want to get into the business and you're heading this way and you got no other place to go and you need money, you do what you got to do.
So how long did you stay in Georgia? And then I guess next up was probably Florida territory for Eddie Graham.
Well, yeah, because when they left, everything kind of shut down and all that. I didn't really live in Atlanta. I was still in Knoxville. I was just driving from Knoxville going down. And then I started doing a lot of the TV there and started hooking up with other guys that were in the Knoxville area doing Atlanta. And then, you know, that kind of dried up. And, you know, I was staying with an aunt and uncle and all that. And there was no work, no wrestling, no money. So I came home. I came back here. And I went down to Tim Horner was here in Tampa at the time wrestling over at the Sportatorium, and I went over there and went in the office, and Charlie Lay, who was, you know, the gatekeeper in the office, you couldn't get past him, you know, unless somebody wanted you to or unless he wanted you to. And I asked Tim Horner if he, you know, if he could, you know, tell him who I was and all this stuff. And see if, you know, maybe I could start doing some TV there on Wednesdays. And, you know, he gets J.J. Dillon comes out, and he just closed the door on me and said, no, we don't need you.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I went back to doing what I was doing. Some friends, you know, that I knew how to do, which I had a skill, which I was a welder. And, you know, my friends here had a steel company. So I went to them, and we were, you know, hanging steel. And I was just, oh, here I was in this area, is, you know, hanging steel and all the jobs here, walking steel and, you know, welding and doing all the, you know, what I needed to do, fabricating. So I became pretty good at that. And then I guess they had a change here in Tampa. And Dory Funk took over as the booker. And they were wrestling downtown here in St. Pete at the Bayfront Center. Well, I got to meet a lot of the guys, and Flair was there that night. I got to, you know, I got to know him a little bit, and Les Thornton was there, and I traveled with him when I was in Knoxville a little bit too. So I decided to go down there and, you know, and say hi. And I'm standing, you know, by one of the doors where they, you know, to the auditorium, and Les Thornton comes out. And I said, and I walked up to him and said, hey, Les, how you doing? And he goes, oh, and he remembered who I was and all that. And we were pretty, you know, somewhat friends. And he goes, hey, how you doing? Are you working? I go, yeah, I'm down here hanging steel down here to some job. And he goes, no, are you working? I said, yeah, I'm welding. I'm hanging steel. He goes, no, are you in the business? I said, no, nobody will talk to me. And so I said, no, I haven't done anything in a while and all that. He goes, well, he says, come with me. Takes me into the dressing room. And then there's a, you know, table there and over the dressing room. He goes, sit here on this table. He goes, just sit here. Don't move. So I'm just sitting there and all the guys are walking around and Flair recognizes me, remembers me. And he walks up to me and he goes, hey, man, how you doing? And, you know, we're friends, shaking my hand and all that stuff. And then, you know, we had a little bit of the same conversation. So here's Les Thornton and Ric Flair, the world champion. And Les Thornton was at that time was the world junior heavyweight champion. And they said, they just told me to sit right there. Finally, Dory walks up to me and he goes, can you do TV Wednesday? I said, are you kidding? I said, yeah, I can do TV. So wow. I go down and do, yeah. So that was the beginning of it here in Tampa.
Wow, and, your phone, just that easy. Hey, can you do TV?
Yeah. So, yeah, showed up to do TV, and, you know, I was my normal, natural self, you know. And, you know, and it was good TV here because, you know, Eddie Graham was the promoter and all that. And, he, you know, Eddie was a solid guy. I, you know, really liked him. He was one of the main person to, you know, that really got me going in the right direction. But anyway, I do TV and, I had to work with Dory. It was Jimmy Garvin. And I get out there and I'm working with Jimmy Garvin and I'm, you know, doing my normal thing. I'm just, you know, moving 99 miles an hour, you know, headed way faster than everybody else. And he's throwing backdrops and I'm going all from one side of the ring to the other side of the ring and backdrops. And I'm up and down. You never let stay down. You always get up. And, you know, a lot of the guys, and especially that we go over there to, you know, they call them enhancement or whatever, but you know, you're working the TV to put over the guys that are working the territory. They call them jobbers, but I don't like that term because, you know, it's just, to me, it's just insulting, you know, because you're going to be putting people over, you know, for most of your life while you're in that wrestling business, regardless of who you are, even if you're Ric Flair. So so I did TV and then, you know, they're all excited about, you know, me being, you know, flying all over the place and up and down and this and that, and I could do just about anything. And, you know, I finally figured out what high spots were, so they could call high spots and all that stuff. And, you know, and they never forgot. So I'm, you know, going all over the place and wrestling and doing this and that and everything else. And, you know, every Wednesday they got me coming down and doing TV. And so they, I'm still having to work because once a week, Wednesday TV was not enough.
Right.
So I'm still working, still welding, but now I'm down here on doing condos, high rises where I'm, you know, putting in stairs and columns and welding them all in place and everything. And I'm having to take off every Wednesday. And finally my boss, he gets mad and he goes, you take off one more Wednesday. He says, you're fired. Okay. Okay. So they call me up during the week and they go, Dory does. And he goes, I need you. He says, can you come in and do TV this Wednesday? I said, no, I can't. My boss told me if I come in and miss another Wednesday, another day at work, he says, I'm done. I can't. He goes, okay. 5 minutes later, Eddie Graham calls me back. He goes, hey, kid. He goes, I need for you to do TV this week. And I'm going, and I just talked to Dory, Eddie. I told him, I'd love to be able to do TV, but I can't because I'm, you know, the only job I have is this job here. I'm welding. I'm only doing this once a week and I can't afford to lose my job. And he goes, oh, okay, kid. Okay. 5 minutes later, Dory calls me back again. And I'm going, Dory, I can't. You don't understand. I can't lose my job. He goes, I understand, kid. He hangs up. But dadgum if Eddie doesn't call me back again. Then he goes, kid, I need you to do TV Wednesday. And I go, Eddie, I can't come. You know, I'm going to lose my job. He goes, I'll pay you double what I pay everybody else. I go, dang. That, you know, it wasn't a lot, but still, I said, well, okay. I'll do it. So I went down there and I worked with Dory that day. And you know, it was a heck of a match, you know, for TV, with me and Dory Funk Jr. And Dory loved me, you know. And evidently Eddie Graham did too. So,
did you lose your job?
Oh, yeah. I got fired.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
You I got fired. Figured that.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and I did some, you know, went down to, I had to go down to the office one day and I walk into the office and, you know, there's Charlie Lay, you know, the gatekeeper, you know, sitting back there handling, hard to get past Charlie Lay. And you go in, Charlie was an old time wrestler and all that, but you walk in the door, you know, and Charlie would lean back in his chair and put his hands behind his head and he'd go, breathe out, and he'd tell stories and wouldn't let you go inside. So I walk in, and damn if he didn't about jump out of his chair. And I'm looking at him, you know, just, I'm going, what in the world, you know, and he's excited. He goes, oh, kid, hey, kid, yeah, wait one minute. And I'm going, Charlie, you okay? He goes, wait a minute. He gets on the phone, and you know, he says, hey, he's here. And I go, okay. And so the door opens up to the locker room in there, and it's Eddie Graham. He came down from upstairs out of his office. And he comes in and he goes, hey, kid, how you doing? He goes, everything okay? And, he's you doing all right? I go, no, not really. And so I got fired. And Eddie goes, oh, shit. And that was his famous thing. He did that. It was either good or bad. Because when he did that, either you lost your job or you got hired. Well, at that time, the tag team, the kids they were using, they were young blood. It was Brian Blair and Terry Allen, Magnum TA. And Terry blew his knee out. And he goes, and I didn't know it at the time. He goes, well, I may have something for you, kid. So I said, okay, yeah, great. And I get a call from Dory later on. He goes, I need you to show up at these towns. He puts me in Terry Allen's spot.
Wow.
And I'm working semi-main events with Brian Blair all over the dang territory. And I'm loving it. I'm in.
Big time.
I'm in. And we're having the matches of our lives, you know, and I'm excited, you know, and we were doing TV. Me and Brian were tagging on TV and we were working with the Hollywood Blondes. And we tore the dang house down on TV and all that stuff. And they're going crazy and they're loving it. And I'm all over the place now and I'm working every night and, you know, 6-7 nights a week. And I'm just going, this is unbelievable. Well, it didn't last all that long. So, it, you know, then because they had a change of the regime, whatever you want to call it. Well, anyway, Booker's changed. Dusty came in and Dory went back to Charlotte, Mid-Atlantic. Well, Dusty pulls in and he wants his crew and his guys, and he's got a big meeting, you know, and that we all are in the where the ring is, sitting in the bleachers. He says, you know, I'm going to pull you all in one at a time, have a conversation with you and let you know where you stand. So he goes through everybody there except for, you know, and I'm waiting for my turn. Oh, my dang, you know, this is not looking good because everybody's going. And then there's three of us left. And I'm looking to the other two and I'm going, this ain't good. So he calls us into the office And he goes, well, you guys are the last one I need to talk to, but I'm sorry to tell you, I'm going to let y'all go. I said, what? And I got to let y'all go. I said, I've been working every night. He goes, yeah, I know. He goes, right now I don't have a spot for you. I don't need you. You know, he said, but you can come back and do TV every week. There we go again. So I do, I didn't have nothing. I lost the other job. So I went back to my friends, their steel company, and I'm doing TV again every week. But at least I got a job, I'm welding, working steel and all that stuff every week, doing okay. And then I'm starting to work with, a lot more of the guys coming in and out and all that. And every Wednesday, everybody's walking in, they're looking at the sheet, see who they're working with. Everybody wanted to see who was working with the kid. They're talking about me. Cause that's who everybody knew that they were working with, if they were working with me on the TV match, they knew that they were going to get over, have a good match. And, instead of going out there and just, pounding, doing a slam job on somebody that, just comes in here every week to collect the $50 check and go home and, have his, 15 seconds of fame or however they say it. Right. So I'm working, I'm doing TV and I'm still in shape and I'm still flying back and all over the place and all, and I'm working with everybody and things are starting to seem like they're picking up again. And I'm down there, we're doing TV. Mike Rotunda comes in again, at that time. Mulligan comes in at that time. Barry's in at that time. And I'm starting to hook up with these guys. And Rotunda likes me because he loved to fish. And he knew I knew all the fishing around here. And, my brother lived in Fort Lauderdale. I lived up here in St. Pete, where the beaches and all that. So I have a match on TV one day and I come out. And, Dusty stood in the next to this desk all the time, watched all the monitor, all the matches. He goes, hey, kid, I walk over and go, yeah, what's up? He goes, what do you want to do? I go, what do you mean? He goes, what is it that you want to do? I said, well, my goal is to be in this business and working full time. He goes, okay, kid, I got a spot for you. So he brings me in and I'm starting to, do more shows and, I'm no longer just doing TV. I'm doing shows all over. And but I'm still getting, still getting beat on TV and working and I'm starting to travel with Mike Rotunda, Mike Davis, Barry Windham. They pull me in and they sit me in the back seat, do the car, tell me don't talk, shut up, just listen. It's okay. Don't talk. I wasn't allowed to talk. I wasn't allowed to do anything except for just ride along, drink beer. So then we start doing, some more on TV and everything. And, Mike comes over. He goes, I says, after your match, I want you, at the end of your match, he says, I want you to come out here and sit out here at the, where you can see the ring and watch every single match. He says, and you don't move. If you move, you're done. It's okay. So I started watching, I started learning, and they started talking to me. Mike Davis was with us at the time, God rest his soul, what a great guy Mike Davis was, what a heck of a talent. So I'm with these two guys, every night, and they're in my ear, in my ear, in my ear. I mean, Eddie Graham's coming down, and he's coming down before I go to the ring. He's in my ear. He's telling me, this is what I want to, I'm getting beat on TV still, but he goes, this is what I want to see you do. He's telling me how to work my matches on TV, even though I'm getting beat. And then, so I'm just, I'm in with everybody right now. And then, Hector Guerrero comes in, and I knew Hector from Chattanooga that time. And never, it's been a couple of years since I seen him, but he comes in and, Eddie goes to, they put me and Hector together and Eddie goes to Hector and he goes, I like that kid. He's got something. He says, I want you to work with him. And, went from there.
And obviously Dusty likes it because you end up in JCP, the Mid-Atlantic, Charlotte territory. And really, I think what a lot of people remember is Starrcade 84. you and Mike Davis. So I feel like Dusty, he definitely liked you. Then you become, of course, the world junior heavyweight champion at the Greensboro Coliseum.
Yeah. I knew it a couple of years earlier. We was in Orlando, and we were selling out everywhere. We was at the Eddie Graham Sports Arena in Orlando, and I'm watching the matches, you know, like I usually do. And Dusty walks up behind me, hits me with that belly, and he goes, "Hey, kid." I go, "Yeah." He goes, "We just had a tournament for the Junior Heavyweight Championship of the World." I go, "Hey, that's great. That's nice." He goes, "You won." I did. We're still in Florida. I didn't know he. This is how far ahead he is. You know, he's already got me in places where, you know, that I'm not even thinking about because I'm in Florida.
Right.
But
yeah.
he's so far ahead that he's already got me world champion. But his plans, his booking and everything was just so phenomenal. It's just such a great mind that he's a year out. And and he had the place to do it was at Starrcade. And, you know, and I didn't even know we were leaving because we did the big show down in Miami. And that's where him and Eddie Graham Dusty and Eddie had fallen out. And then we're over at the Sun Dome here in University of Florida, South Florida. And I didn't know that they had that falling out. I'm just, you know, walking around the dressing room, you know, doing my normal thing. And Kevin, I guess, assumed the book from Dusty, and I didn't know that either. And he walks up to me and he goes, "Can you make a town, you know, this town?" You know, I thought it was kind of strange that he asked me. I look at him, I went to say yes, and Dusty walks over and goes, "No, he's not. He'll be in North Carolina." I guess I looked at him and I went, "Yeah, I don't guess I'm going to be able to make it, Kevin."
He was taking you with him because he was leaving. Yeah.
He sent me way before everybody else came. I was one of the first guys to go. And here I am in North Carolina, you know. But I got to know a lot of the guys. I knew Ron Bass and Black Bart because they were down here and they loved me. Got to work with Tonga, you know, Haku, whatever you want to call him.
Yep.
And I was doing TV with him here. And I'm out there working with him and all that. And he gets me in an arm bar and I'm switching in and out. And he grabs it, goes back, we're switching. And I look up at him and I'm, you know, I don't know the guy. And I hear he's, you know, one of the toughest guys on the planet. And I look up at him in the eyes and I go, "I'm taking you down." And a fireman carry. "Is that okay?" Before he had to say anything, he was on his back. And I go, "Oh, Lord." And I'm looking at him to make sure he's okay. He just grinned. So Ricky Steamboat, he grew up here in this neighborhood too. I went to school with him. So I knew him and he was already there. You know, it was funny. So it was the first time we get to meet, down there at the Croc's place where they're doing promos and all that stuff. And I walk in and sit down and he comes up and goes, "Denny." Him and my brother were really close. Him and his brother Arthur, Ricky, my brother were real close. They all hung out together, fished together. You know, we all kind of did at times, but you know, my brother more so. But he knew me and come up. And he hugged me, shook my hand. He goes, "Hey, glad to have you here, brother." And it went from there.
Very cool. And you had a pretty good run for Crockett. I mean, basically 84, 85, 86, 87. I mean, you were there for quite a bit. I mean, you had a good run.
Yeah, 88. And things changed, I guess. You know, the format and everything was changing. And, you know, we did have a really good run, you know. And things really got wild, you know. And it got really too wild for me, you know, partying and stuff like that. Things were changing and I wasn't working a lot and, you know, I got caught up in a lot of that scene with some of the guys I hooked up with because they weren't monitoring us and it was, you know, it wasn't too good. So the people were leaving. Dusty when we first, after we first got to Charlotte, he lost Barry and Mike anyway. And, you know, we were at the Coliseum over in Charlotte, and Dusty went over to the bar across the street, and I went over there with him. And boy, he was about in tears. I ain't kidding you. He's crying to me about, man, he said, I, this whole thing was based on Barry and Mike coming in there, because that's, you know, that was his top baby faces that were going to be there. And I was hurt too, because there's my buddies. They're taking off on me too. And, you know, I'm going, I know how you feel. But Dusty's more so, because that's what he was going to build the territory around, those two guys. And it was, you know, it was a pretty sad night, me and him sitting there drinking beer, and just, you know, him just, he didn't, it just really changed him a lot. But later on, that was early when we first got there, but later on, you know, then other people started coming in, and then, you know, so I got into some of the guys that just partied a little bit too much, and it was just too much for me. So about 1988, and, you know, everybody was leaving the territory. They were going to Memphis or here or there or whatever. And they shifted to, you know, all the big guys. That's when Lex Luger started coming in. So you had all these big muscle guys and all that stuff. And there was not really any place for me. Everybody was getting contracts, and I wasn't getting a contract, you know, and I wasn't having any place to go. But I should have saw it. I should have left. Should have went to Memphis. But I said, you know what? I'm not happy with the way things are going. I'm not happy with the partying. And I just, you know, I've seen a lot of people dying and stuff. And I said, oh, I'm just not going to do that. I'm not going to be one of those. I don't want to be a statistic. So I just kind of pulled myself out of it. And I went to Arizona, where my dad was, and hung out with him for a while.
So you weren't really wrestling as much sporadically. I know, yeah. You end up in WCW just a little bit here and there. So you're kind of like winding it down and ending the career.
Yeah, pretty much. I was trying to get back into it as well. I thought maybe I could and all that, but you know, I had not really been in the gym working out as much, and I just started gaining weight and, you know, and I wasn't looking, you know, I wasn't looking like I was back in those days. You know, I was 190 pounds when I was at top weight. But, you know, I carried it really well, and I looked good, and I looked believable as a wrestler, but, you know, because, you know, my structure and the frame, you know, even though I wasn't really tall. You know, I remember when Joe Scarpa come over to me in Chilhowee Park in Chattanooga, slid over next to me, and he goes, hey, kid, you know, this is when I'm first starting out. He goes, what are you doing here? And I didn't really know him. That's the first time I ever met him. You know, Chief J. Strombo later on, or where he was then. And I go, I'm working. He goes, no. He goes, what are you doing here? I said, I'm working. He says, no, you're not. Get out. You're too small.
Wow.
You don't think that didn't change my mind? It sat right then and there. That I didn't have something to prove?
Right. Definitely.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he's like the third person who told me that, you know, I had no business. You know, but I just said that, the guy that trained me really instilled a lot of, you know, knowledge and, you know, structure into me, that taught me that, you know, I was more of a technician than I was, you know, just a regular worker. I could incorporate both. The mat skills and work it as a worker into the professional skills too at the same time. And it worked well. It meshed really well together, because I could incorporate it and do the same, you know, with both of it. And it got over.
Definitely. A lot of people remember downtown Eddie Brown as being, you know, a great worker, obviously multiple time NWA junior heavyweight champion of the world. But, you know, everybody remembers you being a really like skilled technician, a great worker.
Yeah. Oh, timing was perfect. I mean, I could, in the middle of the ring, I couldn't talk, you know, I couldn't, I hated to be put on camera and the light go on. As soon as a little red light go on, I'd look at it and go, well, so I stood there one day. I don't know who's going to see all this stuff. And, you know, I saw that light come on one time in Rock Hill, and I looked up at it and I went, oh, and just the word came out. Drop the F-bomb on them, you know.
Oh, not good.
Yeah, though, you know, but so nobody, I never really sat around and stuff. And then I started, you know, trying to work on a few things with it and all that. But it just, you know, I just love the skill and the art of wrestling. And I just really enjoyed that. I didn't really care about, you know, because everybody, you know, the art, you know, I guess of doing promos and stuff like that is just telling stories and, you know, and lying about whatever, you know, because that's what it was. It's made up, you know. I don't know how to lie. I'm not a good liar. It makes me feel horrible. So I don't know how to make things up. And, you know, if I wanted to, if I, you know, so I have to come out and tell you, you know, what I believe and what I feel, and it's going to be the truth. And 9 times out of 10, you know, the stories I tell you that have happened are true or funnier than somebody making up a story and telling a lie.
Yep.
Because it's so amazing and so funny and it's unbelievable. And I've done so much, you know, Australia, Japan, you know, used to go down to Puerto Rico. Dory was the booker down in Puerto Rico and the Bushwhackers were there, you know, and all that. And Dory was infamous for, you know, doing his, you know, 13-page finishes and stuff like that. And I'm down there as the champion and all that, and I'm having a championship match, and he comes out with this 13-page, you know, finish. And, you know, the Bushwhackers are sitting there listening to him and all that, and I'm just shaking my head, yeah. And the Bushwhackers go, "Did you get all that?" And Dory looks at him and goes, "He's the damn champion. You're damn right he got it."
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah, so it was a good match. I worked with a kid I never met before, one of the Riveras, just really good match, really fun time down in Puerto Rico. Good time in Japan too. Australia was okay. I guess the guy didn't like me too much because we didn't wrestle. All we did was, it was more of a boxing match to me than anything else. Was all he wanted to do was punch me in the face. I'd punch him back. So that's pretty much what those matches were like. And, but it was an experience, you know. I mean, what are you going to do? You don't get to do all these things, you know, maybe once in your life, if at all. But, it was a great experience, you know. And I always go back to my childhood thinking that, you know, all the stuff that happened to me in my childhood really, you know, led up to this, built up to the fact that, you know, that I could get out there and do the things that I did and take literally the punishment that I did because of the punishment I took as a child growing up by my brothers. You know, I was 5 years old, you know, got a chin-up bar in the doorway, had to do chin-ups, squats, push-ups, and everything. You know, we had PT every morning, every night, got out in the backyard, got a whooping every night from my dad. We got into an argument with my brother, had to push the furniture up against the wall, get on our knees, stand face-to-face. He'd stand over us with the belt, first one stopped, first one cried, we'd get whooped. You know, that's growing up. And then when he left and you know, went off back off to wherever the heck he went as a Marine. And I had two brothers, and you know, they loved to beat me up. They take turns and beat me up all day long. So by the time I got into wrestling, and you know, I figured if, you know, the guy that trained me, Rick Connors, I said, "Well, heck, all the stuff that you're doing, though, you might be beating me, but you're not beating me up because if that's all you got, you know, I'll tap out all day long, but I don't never quit." And that's what happened. And that's how what led me into what became a part of, you know, I could do anything out there. And, you know, and these guys were, you know, I was not the biggest guy out there, and I was pretty small. And I worked with all the biggest guys there were. And all those big guys that really enjoyed working with me, who liked me, really gave me a lot of the matches that, you know, normally they wouldn't give to any other guy. I mean, I get 300-pound guys like Black Bart, and you know, in the heat of a match, you know, and me making a comeback, pick me up, slam. I'm looking at myself, you're 300 pounds. before I know it, I got him up in the air, bam, he's down on the mat, slammed him. Mark Lewin comes in, the Purple Haze, and I'm working with a match with him out there, and he's loving the match. He's going, and he does the same thing. I make a comeback, fire up, boom, bang, slam, pick me up, bam, man, I'm going, they're putting me over. I'm not winning, but as a fighter, and Mike Rotundo instilled this into me. He says, don't ever stop fighting and get back up, fight back every time. Even it's work, man, you know that. But he says, but it's the image and picture and what you're giving, you know, what you're portraying. You want to be a competitor, you know, a fighter. You know, if you can't fight, you're not going to go out there and fight back. And you go out there and just lay down like 90% or 95% of the guys that come down to do TV every week. That's all you're going to do every week. It's TV, nothing else.
Yep. So as we hit the wind down here, we head towards the finish. What's next for you? I know you mentioned the gathering, but what else is next for you as far as wrestling is concerned?
Well, I don't really have anything. I don't have an agenda because I don't really promote myself to anything, you know. Everybody's doing a lot of different things and signings and stuff like that. I'm happy. I got a nice home. Like I said earlier, you know, I bought this home, you know, 2.5 years ago, and I've been remodeling the whole house, working outside, and I'm going to the gym. I'm still in pretty good shape. And, you know, I can't go back and wrestle now because I've had to have surgeries because they have caught up to me, and I had two this year. And they're not going to let me back in the ring anymore. But as far as going to do, you know, signings and stuff like that, people just, you know, I don't know. I don't know what it is or what, you know, they just don't seem to flock to me. So I don't really have anything that I've, that I have on the table, except for this thing. Like I said, you know, then you call, you text me, and the thing that I'm doing, the gathering. But anything else in itself, I really don't have anything, and I'm okay with that. You know,
do you have social media though? Do you have something to throw out there and promote so people maybe can reach out and connect?
No, not really. It's Facebook is all it is, you know. And I get all these friend requests all the time, but I don't do it, you know, because a lot of them, when you're friend requesting, they want to go to Messenger and they want to talk to you all night long. Then they want to mail you pictures and they want you to sign them. And, you know, if I start doing all that, and then what happens is that I'm giving it away for nothing. Then who, you know, they're not going to come to the signing and stuff. But it's going to come to the point where it's going to catch up, because when the guy announced me the gathering, when he announced me, I was really kind of shocked of the feedback and the comments that I got, that the, you know, stating how, you know, a rare opportunity, a rare, you know, a rare find that they're going to be bringing me to, you know, Charlotte. So it was positive for me,
for sure,
that I saw that, because, you know, I didn't realize it was out there. And I've been to a couple of, you know, signings, and, you know, and I guess that, you know, they don't want to pay me. That's for some reason. And, you know, maybe I'm not the business guy that I probably should be. You know, I'd rather go out and catch redfish all day long. And somebody fly me up there, you know, not pay me anything.
Right, right.
You know, the gym's a mile away. You know, I had back surgery back in May. I was physical therapy today to stretch me out. I got back home. I walked to the gym. It's a mile. I did legs, walked back home another mile. You know, rehabbing, just getting myself back in shape. You know, trying to, you know, I'm 66 years old now. Manny Fernandez texted me the other day, and he goes, hey, they want me to have my last match over in Orlando in January. He goes, you want to work with me? I'm going, hell no. I can't work with you.
Crazy.
But he wanted me to work with him because, you know, he also was another guy that took me under his wing and stuff like that. And, took care of me and stuff like that, and love me. He always calls me the toughest little shit he ever knew.
Nice nickname.
Yeah. Yeah. That's his favorite saying. But yeah, it was, I get, you know, I mean, every, you know, if I go to some of these other things where, you know, they have these Legends luncheons over here in Tampa, and I go there. I go to those once in a while, but, you know, this year I haven't gone so much because they had, you know, I had three discs slipping out of my neck, so I had to have those replaced, and I didn't have four discs in my lower back were almost completely gone, and the bones were slipping out of whack and stuff like that. So I had neck surgery in January to have that fixed, and then I did the lower back in May, like I said. And, you know, I'm just glad that I'm not in a, you know, that I'm not crippled in a wheelchair, and you know, I'm healing up pretty well, and I'm getting active again, and, you know, working out and getting some good workouts in and getting strong again. So I'm, you know, that's really kind of the first thing that I want to do. And maybe this thing in Charlotte will, you know, put me back out there. People will see me again, and, you know, maybe they'll get some more requests to have me come in and do some of the signings and things that a lot of the guys are doing these days. But a lot of what you see is the WWE guys, and, you know, the ones from the Attitude Era days with all those guys, you know, that when Vince took over and put everybody out of business, I mean, that was the only thing everybody's seen. So what, you know, today is a new age of far getting, you know, to the public is, you know, let's get you in, sell some pictures and do some autographs and talk to you and do interviews. You know, who knows? I don't know where this goes. Maybe this goes out to somewhere. Somebody sees it and says, and doesn't know all the stuff of my story, that maybe this puts that story out there that somebody sees and says, well, maybe we ought to start bringing him out more.
Right. Sounds good. Sure. Yeah. Never know. You know,
And, you know, I've had a lot of opportunities to do these, but I've never done with anybody because they're never, you know, they never, nobody ever follows up. And, you know, and I thought, if they don't call me or, you know, follow up, that's why I said to you, I said, well, at least call me, let me know, because that way I know you're for sure. And then I did forget today was Thursday.
It happened. Yeah.
Well, you know, I mean, it's really just every day is the same. The only thing, you know, I go and look at the time schedules and all that is what time is the, you know, when the tides are and, you know, what the, how the wind's blowing and where's the moon.
Yep.
You know, I won't go fishing. And as a matter of fact, I'm going Sunday. I'm going up to Brooksville, and I'm going fishing with Mike Rotundo. He's got his boat up there. He's finally got it in the spot. And he and I, we're still fishing. We've been fishing together for 40 years. And I'm going again Sunday, and I'll stay up there. You know, he married Stephanie Windham, so they're like family to me. And you know, so I'm going up there, stay with him for a couple of days. We'll go out Crystal River, go fishing up there. He'll tell me about all the signings he's doing, and I'll just sit there and go, yeah, that's nice. Why don't you throw my name around once in a while?
Yeah, there you go.
He does. He's a good guy. He really is. He's one of the best guys that, you know, that I've known in the business, and we've been close friends for a lot of years, and he helped me get through a lot of, you know, to you know, work my way through it, and help me, you know, understand the psychology of the, you know, the business and the, and how, you know, wrestling, and really what helped me get over as a wrestler, as a smaller guy at that.
Well, Danny, thank you so much for all the time today. Really appreciate going, taking a trip down memory lane, if you will, but thank you so much for all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. I was glad to do it. I didn't know if I was going to be able to stay awake this long.
Thank God you did, but yes, thank you so much.
Absolutely, I appreciate it. Thank you for the opportunity to be able to give a little bit of the story. So it's nice.
This has been a John Paz Power Trip production in conjunction with the Two Man Power Trip of Wrestling. You could follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Two Man Power Trip. You could check us out on Facebook. You could subscribe on YouTube. You can go to patreon.com/TMPTEmpire to become a patron, and also check out the website TMPTEmpire.com and buy a shirt at ProWrestlingTees.com. Two Man Power Trip, where the power lies, brother.